Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
And I know that there's been years, not this year in Northwest Kansas, but years when we've had this puny, pathetic, dried up corn that we thought would be really high, and it was actually, it never got that far. So sometimes we're surprised what's out there when we actually go and test it.
Kansas State Beef Specialist Sandy Johnson on nitrate toxicity.
So as a plant matures, it tends to, it's using up the nitrogen we put in the soil, and it's where it's supposed to be and not concentrated in the base of the plant. But, we have all this range of growing conditions that can cause it, different variations of things to happen on where it is. And so sampling, get a good sample, send it off, use that information to make decisions.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
No, it's a long process. And, we've seen some rains in some areas. And Oklahoma, generally speaking, it has improved a lot.
Dr. Darrell Peel, Oklahoma State livestock economist, on whether we're rebuilding the herd.
North and south of us up into Kansas, there's some improvement in some areas, but some other areas still struggling a lot with drought conditions. Down into Texas, in central Texas, there's a lot of drought. The panhandle's in fairly good shape, much like Oklahoma, but the point, and it goes on into Nebraska and over into Missouri. So we do have some significant drought issues, and it's still early enough in the year, in the summer here, with the kind of heat that we're seeing, that we could actually see these drought conditions redevelop. I think producers logically are being a little bit cautious about the potential for us to slide backwards, even in places where we've made some improvement.
So one of the questions is, what could be ahead?
Going forward into the fall, I think, all of these things were, hopefully the broader weather environment is that El Nino continues to develop and that increases the odds of improving conditions, but that maybe takes much of the rest of the year. So we're really setting up for better conditions next year, I think, and for sure better conditions even for the remainder of this year. So that's one issue. And then I think producers, once they kind of get out of the worst of those drought areas or drought situations, then can start thinking about a little bit more of an offensive plan, if you will. We've been on defense trying to get through this thing. I think we can now start to think about how we're going to take advantage of the strength that we've got in these cattle markets. And we expect that strength to continue. It will be extended a little bit because we are a little bit slow in rebuilding the herd this time.
Producers also starting to question whether or not we could see more wheat grazing this fall.
In the Southern Plains, winter wheat, grazing winter wheat is an important stocker, primarily activity, although it's also used for cow-calf. We have not had good years the last two or three years because of drought. Right now, at least in some parts of the Southern Plains where we have gotten some rain, we're situated a little bit better for the potential for early planting winter wheat, which is what producers who want the forage part of winter wheat are interested in. So, at this point in time, at least down in Oklahoma, I would say that the odds are pretty good. We're going to see more potential for producers who want to do that, to plant wheat early and have that additional feed resource going forward. Later on, there'll be a lot of questions about sort of the budget, if you will, for these stocker cattle. And, the feeder price, the stocker price, I should say, is going to be very strong. So we'll have to do some budget work to see how it actually looks economically. But at least I think from the standpoint of the physical or the production environment, we have a chance for some decent early winter wheat planting coming up in the next 2 to 4 weeks.
Underlines the importance of planning.
The time to plan is earlier rather than later. Look at what's out there. The futures market can provide a guide. Now, one of the other things I should mention is that lightweight calves, when we use the futures market, of course, we have to take into account the basis, the difference between cash and futures prices. And in these high-priced markets like we have now, like we had in 2014 and 15, the basis on these lightweight calves will get a lot wider. So if you use historical records, that's our base. That's our data for historical basis. If you look back to the 2014-15 period, you're going to find basis is a lot wider here, and it's been building this year for these lightweight stocker calves on the feeder cattle futures market.
Where to focus?
We need to just obviously get the physical environment, our resource situation taken care of, get pastures healed up, get those hay supplies replenished. But then we can, start to think a little bit more proactively, if you will, a little more aggressively about what our plans are going forward, recognizing that we're going to be in these strong cattle markets, especially feeder cattle markets, as we go forward through the rest of this year and on through 2024.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Termination methods, kind of jumping ahead if we're having an overwintering cover crop and terminating in the spring. Herbicides continues to be the most common way farmers are usually doing that, with 55 having that as their usual control method.
Dr. Rob Myers, University of Missouri, looking at the 2023 National Cover Crop Survey results.
Now, quite a few farmers still use cover crops at winter kill. Those might be oats or radishes that are going to die in late fall by the winter conditions. When we get into the horticulture users is where we're going to start to see some mowing or tillage. It would be somewhat rare for a grain farmer to use mowing, for example, to kill their cover crop. We do also see some use of roller crimper. Now, that could be both horticulture users and some organic grain farmers will use roller crimper, and even some non-organic grain farmers. So that is still a modest practice in terms of percentage of use, but getting a little more popular. And then tarping, if you're wondering about that, that's kind of showing up on some small acreage vegetable farms as a way to kill the cover crop without having to till the soil or do other disturbance as an alternative to perhaps mowing the cover crop.
But what about incentives to grow cover crops?
There's been lots of discussion as of late about cover crop incentives, whether it's climate smart programs, boost in money for NRCS, or even the private sector. We found in terms of farmers that had reported on their experience with cover crop payments that 72% of those that did not get a payment in 2022 had never received a payment. Now, I want to stress this is not all the farmers in the survey. This is those that did not take a payment in 2000, or I'm sure he did take a payment in 2022 or didn't. So they had reported on that. So quite a few had never received a payment. You can see that EQIP was the most popular of the remaining payments. And then in terms of the type of payment that they did receive in 2022, looking just at those that received payments, we saw, again, quite a few different approaches that were received here, including some with private company payments is getting more common. A lot of farmers were in that pandemic program to get a crop insurance rebate, or they might have been in Iowa, Illinois, or some other states that were offering state-level crop insurance rebates. The number of years of incentive payments, it varies. EQIP contracts are normally 3 years for cover crops. CSP payments are typically 5 years for cover crop payments. Some state programs are 1 or 2 years, so it just varies. Lots of variation among the private sector programs, too. But you can see one thing I would stress is this is the total years that the farmer has received some incentive payments, so not necessarily on a given field. They may have signed up one field for a three-year EQIP contract, then as that expired, signed up some other fields. But certainly some farmers that have had incentives for a number of years. Now, this is the big question I hear a lot is once that incentive payment goes away, does the farmer stick with cover crops? And this is really a strong answer on that. The 67% said definitely yes, they're going to stick with cover crops after those payments end. Another 22, almost 23% probably yes. So we're looking at about 90% are saying they're either definitely or probably going to stick with cover crops after those incentive payment ends. So I think that's one of the key findings in the survey. We'd never asked that question before, and it is a common one that comes up in policy circles. And on the flip side, we only had about 3% that said they would stop using cover crops, either probably or definitely after the incentive ends. So 90% saying it's either definitely or probably continuing, only 3% saying they are definitely going to stop the cover crops or probably discontinue.
Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
So I have a podcast called What Color Is Your Tractor? And I have another podcast called North American Ag Spotlight.
Chrissy Wozniak is a Florida agribusiness and marketing consultant.
But this What Color Is Your Tractor has been kind of my baby that I've thought about for years and years and years, and it took COVID for it to actually become a thing. And the reason it's called What Color Is Your Tractor is because I've been involved in agriculture my whole life. And in back in Aggie school and college, I would see how these farm boys would just get so excited and angry over the color of their tractor. And I just thought, this is crazy. Like, I love horses and I love calves. And right. So that was my angle. And I just thought it was so interesting. And then working in agriculture, you see the stories of the manufacturers really really is very interesting to me. And I've been very lucky to travel North America for my whole career, and I've got to know a lot of the manufacturers, and they have incredible stories. Incredible stories. You know, just sitting around together at trade shows or whatever, and being able to learn their stories and learn their histories and their challenges and how they built their companies is just so interesting to me. So it's called What Color Is Your Tractor? The Ag Brands You Love and the Ag Brands You Love to Hate. So once a month, I just sit down with a manufacturer and talk about their story. So we just released John Deere, where I sat down with Neil Dahlstrom, who's the archivist at John Deere, and he told me some really cool things about John Deere that I had no idea about. But I also interviewed Jim Mendez from Krohn last month, and the month before that was the great Don Landall. And I've taken that factory tour, and I knew when I had this idea, I think it was probably in that factory tour, that I knew I wanted to do something like this someday. And his life and his legacy is just incredible. So I'm so fortunate that I got to sit down and talk to Don Landall himself, and that he would share this with us. So that's What Color Is Your Tractor.
Are producers using social media to their advantage?
I would say yes. It's very important to share our stories, right? Share the stories of ag. It's very important for that to get out into the public, especially to the end user who's so far away from the farm. The one mistake that I see over and over again is that we forget to pivot and help the consumer understand how it helps them. We tend to position ourselves as the hero, and we're not the hero. We're the guide who tries to help the consumer become either healthier or stronger or less pain or, you know, so many other things. But we always have to remember how it affects that end user. And that's, you know, key to all marketing. That's part of the algorithm. You have to show the consumer what's in it for them. So, you know, keep sharing your stories, but also, tell them why. Tell them always explain why. And I think that'll go a long way. And then not just be an echo chamber, just, you know, saying, look how great we are. We live in the country and we wear boots.
So what are some adjustments we can make when using social media?
There's so many issues in agriculture. And I guess one thing that's tough and I think is a big divide in agriculture is us fighting amongst ourselves over farming methods. So, and I see so much of that online, and really it just makes us look bad. So why can't we just say, I'm no-till. You know, let's not fight about it. Let's say, you know, you have a great point there and I have a great point here, and we're going to farm our land the way we want to, and just leave it there, and instead, and then try to make a better marketing message to the consumer. I think we should all be thinking that we're not just talking to each other. You know, we're always the face of agriculture to the people that are sitting at their table enjoying their food every day.
This is Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I've complimented the Biden administration where they've done the right thing on China, and I think they've kept a lot of our policies in place.
Speaking at a Hudson Institute event on China and the global supply chain, Robert O'Brien, former National Security Advisor.
I think Jake Sullivan has been particularly good, the National Security Advisor on China. But they face the same issues that we face. You know, Treasury, which is riddled with Wall Street folks, is very accommodationist towards China. You see Janet Yellen, you know, going to China and bowing to Xi Jinping and, you know, kowtowing in a way that we haven't seen in many years. That was not a good sign, especially on the heels of the Chinese spy balloon that brazenly, you know, came across our country, on the heels of finding out that, you know, that there are reports, and we'll have to see how they play out, that the Chinese had a weapons lab in California that they were running. So, yeah, the Chinese are continuing to keep up their malign activity, and we need to keep the pressure on them. And so some of these visits to China and the attempts, and look, it's reasonable. Appeasement is something that in a democracy is very popular, because we think other people are like us. We project our beliefs and our kind of reasonableness on other people. So we think if we stretch out our hand and say, look, we want to get along, we want to work things out with you, we'll get the reciprocity from the other side. We'll never get reciprocity. They'll take whatever we give them and say, what have you done for me lately? There's no benefit from this one-sided diplomacy. If we give you something now, you'll be considerate of us later. You'll do the right thing later. You'll apologize for the spy balloon, and you'll tell us that the Wuhan lab had an accidental leak and we got COVID and it wasn't your fault, but it happened, and how do we work to prevent it again? That will never happen with the Communist Party of China or any Communist Party. So we need to understand that. So going to your question, so I think it's been a mixed bag within the administration. I think we have some hawks on China, Kirk Campbell and Jake Sullivan at the NSC. I think you've got Yellen. I think you've got a lot of the people we've worked with at the State Department that just want to do diplomacy and have agreements and accommodations and appeasement and go back to how it was in the old days with China. I think Secretary Blinken's been pretty good, but I don't think he's been, he certainly hasn't been Mike Pompeo with China. Look, the Chinese are so brutal, their own foreign minister disappeared. I mean, we don't even know what happened to their foreign minister. I mean, can you imagine if Tony Blinken just disappeared and was scrubbed from the State Department and no one in the news media was able to mention his name? I mean, that's the type of regime we're dealing with.
There's also the question about lobbying.
The Chinese have a lot of money. And what the Soviet Union didn't have was the kind of wealth that the Chinese have generated. The Chinese have generated massive wealth. We've never faced the challenges as Americans like we're facing as communist China now. Maybe in the revolution, maybe when we're fighting England, the UK is the dominant superpower in the world to get our independence. But since that time, we haven't faced a challenge. And one of the reasons of the challenge is because the Chinese use every tool of national power, including their economic weight, to hire former congressmen, former officials. And they either hire them through TikTok or through a Chinese company, or they hire them directly as lobbyists. And then they fight in the halls of Congress and in the administration to promote China's agenda here in America. Now, think about this. If America and American companies hired a bunch of former Chinese officials in Beijing to go into the Communist Party, into the People's, the Great Hall of the People, into the Congress, the Central Committee, as basically foreign agents to advocate for America, how long do you think those lobbyists in China would last? I mean, they'd be taken out faster than Hu Jintao got escorted out of the Party of Congress that we all saw on TV. So there's no reciprocity, but because we're open and the Chinese understand our system, they're taking advantage of it. And the lobbyists are just one example.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Well, I think there's a strong interest in continuing to increase the incentives, no matter how they're proposed.
Andy Levine is CEO of the American Seed Trade Association, talking about cover crops.
Whether it's a cash payment, whether it's a reduction in crop insurance or others, I think everyone's looking at what best fits in farm policy, what will best fit in this farm bill over the next 5 years to be able to increase that adoption. And then, what does that look like as users begin to wean off of those incentives for the acres over that time? But whenever we've talked to farmers that have been involved in it for mainly 5 years or more, they're pretty much acolytes for using a cover crop, especially on those more vulnerable areas and those more vulnerable parts of their operation that need either that retention or they need that organic matter buildup and everything. And so I think the support's going to continue to be there. I think it's going to continue to be there at the federal level, the state level, and from the private sector. I mean, it's almost every day we see a major corporation coming out working with an environmental group, a grower group, and others to incentivize farmers to, continue to adopt these types of practices for environmental sustainability. But using cover crops is one of those key tools.
There are and have been some problems associated with cover crop seed availability.
We did reference this in one of the questions, and I think Ryan reported on it. There's less than 10%, I believe it was around 7%, Ryan, if I'm right, farmers who had a challenge finding the seed that they wanted, or a shortage of seed. We think that there will always be plenty of seed out there. We have to make sure that we have plenty of understanding of what the intentions are and what the farmers plan to do from season to season. It's like any other seed. You can't just start to produce cover crop seed when the demand comes in. You've got to estimate what it's going to be like a year or 2 years out or more to be able to find the farmers to grow that seed, multiply that seed, and then have it prepared for the farmers when they ask for it or order it. So I thought the numbers were pretty encouraging because there have been some people out there saying we don't have enough seed, there's problems and everything else. When it's 7%, I think that's a pretty good number, and I think we're really trying to meet that demand. And I would probably say, and I don't think it came out in the report, Ryan, but I would probably say that 7%, some of that is driven by programs that have come out in the last 2 years that are really incentivizing the use of cover crops. So you're seeing a quick uptake of participating in programs as quickly as possible.
But at this point, trying to find any additional money for Farm Bill programs will be difficult.
it's really one where, you know, you've got your commodity programs, your Title I, you've got your conservation, you've got your research. Each part of the Farm Bill has its component of support, funding, drivers, those kind of things. And there are a lot of areas within the Farm Bill that need additional resources. Well, we understand that we're going to have limited resources, but conservation, sustainability, those programs are always going to be a strong part of the Farm Bill. And I don't think a reallocation of resources from that to something else is a strong way to go. I think we need to continue to support the evolution of these programs and see that adoption. As Rob said, we're probably at 25 million to 30 million acres, maybe, of cover crops. We look at least 200 million acres of corn and beans in the Midwest, and then you start throwing in cotton and wheat and everything else. Those are important acres to get conservation programs and sustainability programs on. Cover crops is one of those, and those incentives are important to get that adoption and continue to get the program results that we're looking for out of things like cover crops. So, yeah, I think it's going to continue to be a discussion, but I don't think it's an either-or in this case.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We're very interested in pursuing a bilateral agreement with the United Kingdom.
Kent Backus is the Senior Director for International Trade for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
You know, a couple of years ago with Brexit, they left the European Union and started negotiating their own trade agreements. They just implemented one with Australia. They implemented another one with New Zealand. But their first choice was the United States. And, you know, unfortunately, with the change in administrations, the current administration hit pause on those negotiations. And so the British weren't going to wait forever, so they started looking for other dance partners and went out and met up with the Australians and the Kiwis. But they really do want a relationship with the U.S. They want a bilateral agreement that's going to encourage trade between our countries. And it's interesting because you know, we talk about the special relationship with Great Britain, and you know, we have, you know, a very close relationship on security issues, and on a whole host of other things, and we're always shoulder to shoulder and aligned. Yet we don't have a trade agreement, and so even though we have a lot of business that flows between our two countries, we don't have a trade agreement that actually fosters that or protects, companies from being subject to, politics. And so, trade agreements are good because everyone agrees on rules of trade and then allows competition to pursue that. So, we're limited right now. We do have a little bit of access into the UK, but we can only sell 1,000 metric tons annually. And that's 1,000 metric tons under the Hilton quota, which I'm getting really technical on trade nerd speak here, but that means that's your non-hormone treated cattle, but that's also hit with a 20% tariff on top of it. So if you're talking about a really small quota, a high tariff, and a limited, production source, there's not a lot of return on investment right now. But you're talking about a British consumer base that loves beef, and they love sophisticated beef. They love beef with a story. They love high-quality beef, and that's exactly what we have.
As part of the USMCA, one of the member countries can't have a free trade agreement without the others agreeing to it.
That's something I haven't heard about in quite a long time. And, you know, Canada and Mexico negotiate trade agreements all the time. The United States is not out there, you know, saying, no, you can't do this. I think that's a check against, you know, maybe negotiating with some nefarious partners in other parts of the world. I think with the United Kingdom, we all work closely with the British, and I mean, we, especially the U.S. and Canada, we're all part of the same security network, and so I think that's going to be, you know, a natural fit. The U.S. is sovereign, and the U.S. is going to negotiate with whoever they want to. They're obviously going to notify trade partners whenever they're doing that, and everybody reads our press anyway, so they're going to see it. But at the end of the day, it's Congress that ultimately sets trade policy for the United States. They send the executive branch out to, you know, to do the dirty work, so to speak, negotiate it and use that skill set, with consultation from Congress. But it's Congress and the American people that decide terms of trade, not foreign powers. And so I think when this finally, you know, moves through, I don't think there'll be any opposition. It's trade with the United Kingdom. It is a natural fit for us. There's a lot of benefits, a lot of similarities, and not a lot of the concerns that, you know, folks have as far as environment, labor, human rights that you may have in other parts of the world. I think this is the right direction that we should go. We should be trading more with our allies. We should be building those supply chains with them. And we look forward to moving forward with that in 2022 and beyond.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Higher rice yields from the previous month in USDA's August domestic balance sheet. This is World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Mark Jekanowski.
Rice yield increased by 100 pounds per acre, which leads to about a 2.6 million hundredweight increase in domestic production,
offset by an adjustment to last marketing year's ending stocks,
reflecting an increase in our export forecast, all reflecting higher exports of medium and short grain, which we raised 2 million hundredweight, more than offsetting a reduction in our long grain forecast,
meaning a rise in ending stocks for the 2023-24 marketing year.
We also raised our season average price forecast, increased to 70 cents per hundredweight to $17.70 per hundredweight, and that reflects the very strong global prices that we've been seeing, particularly for long grain rice. So our long grain rice forecast was actually raised a dollar per hundredweight.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.